Good morning. I probably should have waited a little longer. So, last time, we talked about sort of some issues with performance and sliding window design. And we talked about this idea of kind of the bandwidth delay product, that we wanted to fill the length entirely, and if we wanted to think of how much do we need to do that, we look at sort of how many packets can we send across the link per unit time, times how long does it take for us to send a packet and get back an app that lets us send the next packet. And so this gives us the bandwidth delay product as kind of a good sort of rule of thumb for what kind of our maximum window size is. And we saw we can actually exceed it a little bit. Because there's generally queues on our network that have some capacity, and as we fill them, we increase the delay from the delay without anything happening. Though when I showed that example last time, I neglected an issue with sort of assuming that everything was kind of spread out evenly, and that's not really what happens. So, in the example I showed last time, we had this maximum window size achieved at sort of this bandwidth delay product without any queuing was 20. And that was sort of our window size that first achieved essentially the maximum possible throughput. And the throughput collapsed a little later at 22. And I kind of falsely asserted, oh, that's when our queues are full. And that's not quite what was happening. And you could tell that because the scenario I had there said, oh, well, we had a queue that pulled 20 packets. That's 4 milliseconds. And that would suggest a window size of 40 is where we'd expect the collapse. So what explained this huge difference? And the answer was that kind of our filling the queue filling the network assumption is kind of assuming that, you know, we don't have losses from queues getting full, and if we evenly spread things out, that's what will happen, right? The queue will always have basically the same amount of stuff in it all the time because everything's evenly spread out. But my implementation was very bursty. It basically tried to send a lot of things at once. Most commonly when we're starting the connection, I did the sort of lazy thing of just send everything right now. And that has the problem of sort of increasing the queue occupancy well above kind of the average we'd expect for that window size. And when that exceeded things, I lost data, and recovering from the lost data took extra time and meant I wasn't making good use of the bandwidth because we're sending extra stuff, right? We can't possibly achieve the full bandwidth if we're sending 2 or 3 copies of some packets. And this is actually a problem with kind of real implementations of things like TCP. So usually it's not so bad a problem because kind of in the steady state, we're sending 1 packet per app, basically, or a small number of packets per app. And that kind of clocks us in a reasonable way. So it kind of keeps. But it still actually ends up being a problem, and there's a whole bunch of literature on solutions to this. Probably the most straightforward thing is something commonly called TCP pacing, where you just deliberately estimate the round trip time and spread out when you're sending things. This is actually very annoying to implement, is my understanding, because because basically it means you have to have timer interrupts go off at specific times in order to make this happen or have some extra support from the network. But some TCP implementations actually do that for performance reasons. Okay, so that's on our bandwidth delay problem. Then we started talking about TCP. So we mentioned this idea of how TCP deals with sequence numbers and ACK numbers. So we have these acknowledgments, and we mentioned the acknowledgments are cumulative, right? So the ACK number says everything up to but not including this byte number is acknowledged. Sort of first, one past, I should say last. So everything up to but not including that byte number is acknowledged. That's what our TCP ACK information tells us. And the sequence number is the byte number for the first data byte in the packet. So if we have a, if we're sending a TCP packet with sequence number, let's do sequence number like 10 and size 13, we actually expect an ACK back for 24. So, questions on that? Okay, and then we started going into what will be our main topic for today, which is talking about switches. And we're going to start talking about sort of switches that are switching Ethernet, and we started talking about sort of what's sent in Ethernet, that's sort of our classical wire network. And we saw we had these frames, which were pretty straightforward. We had some addresses saying where it came from and where it's going. And we had the actual data and some checksum and some stuff to sort of represent start and end, kind of in the same philosophy as our framing assignment. But it turns out Ethernet, you know, sort of has some side signals about where messages start and end that are kind of electric. And we mentioned that since Ethernet was built on this kind of multi-access model originally, that the destinations used to filter things, and this is going to be helpful for our switches because we always have a backup option of send something that someone doesn't care about and they'll filter it out if it's not for them. And then we started talking about sort of how we make switches and sort of how switches work internally, and I kind of introduced the notion of software-defined networks for this, and that was this idea that historically networking equipment was kind of very bespoke and very heavy into fixed functionality, where if you didn't like what the equipment did out of the box, you probably didn't have too many options. Like, there's some stuff you could change, but wasn't very programmable. And there's been a movement to making the network equipment more programmable and more automatically configurable. And we're going to take advantage of that to look at the example of P4, which is an interface for programming what we call the data plane, the actual sort of packet processing pipeline. And I should say, I'm doing this not because I think P4 is going to be the future of switches. I don't know that, you know, it's actually going to be, that's actually that likely that, say, in 10 years, you'll be able to buy sort of typical switches for a data center type environment and they'll support being programmed with P4. But I'm using it as an example because it, you know, it's designed with how switches are architected, even if they aren't programmable in mind. And so it tells us a lot about sort of what is actually happening in those non-programmable switches. So before I start talking about that, questions about things we covered last time? Yeah.
I guess I still have some question about the big drop in like the throughputs. So I know that you mentioned like the it's because of the burst of sending packets and it's and basically exceed what the queue can handle. Mm-hmm. But given that case, doesn't the queue just drop, for example, when it's 22, right? Doesn't it just drop like the final two packages and then send it along with the next 18 extra? So like, why would it result in nearly a half?
So the question is, given that we're not dropping so many packets, why does it result in such a huge drop in throughput?
Yes.
The problem is that it takes the time we could have spent sending like 20 more packets to detect that those two packets were lost.
Okay. Yeah, I think I
know what it is. It's not just gonna, it's gonna be in the middle once we get going. It's not just gonna be at the end. And probably, another thing is that possibly my scheme was not as good at recovering from lost packets as it could have been. So I think it could have been a lot better if I was better at dealing with like doing selective acknowledgments or handling my logic for duplicate acts better, which I did not. Right, so that would definitely help with this situation. But kind of the key thing we were missing is we were assuming in our calculations there were no drones. So we didn't even take into account how bad is recovering from a drop going to be. But it certainly could probably be a lot better, you know, if I implemented a bunch of the heuristics we talked about. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? It seems like the viable part one assignment is not, seems to be going better than the framing assignment was, so. But any questions on that, or the part two assignment that is due in 2 weeks after month Friday? Okay. Yes?
I do have a question about when Professor Campbell will be covering. Will he be recording lectures?
He should be recording lectures. Sometimes technical things happen when it's the person's first time doing it in this environment, but hopefully he'll have recorded lectures.
Okay.
So I mentioned we're going to do P4, and we're going to have an assignment in P4 after the reliable part 2 assignment, where we're going to start you off with a simple switch that doesn't know where to direct frames, so it's just going to broadcast them everywhere. It's going to do that fallback strategy. And we'll have a controller that configures the switch, and in the VM you'll have a simulated 4-machine network that's all the machines are connected to the switch. And your task will be to have the controller write sort of the configuration about where to send what packet, where to send what frames. And also to, as a sort of second part, modify the data plane to send some stuff to the control plane so the control plane can actually, rather than building that statically, can build it dynamically. And we'll talk about what the strategy for that will be in the future. Hopefully today, if not today, next week. Yeah.
Sorry, this is about the previous topic with the reliable assignment. So for part two, is there also going to be like a similar auto grader to part one, or is it going to be?
For part two, is there going to be a similar auto grader? Yeah, and the auto grader is just running commands and checking thresholds. Yeah, and I guess I would say it's possible I set some of those thresholds wrong. And if so, please let me know, because it's my first time doing the assignment and I have a reference solution I'm checking, but it's possible I didn't think through what the range of reasonable values for things was. And if it's wrong, I will look at your code and see what you're doing to like actually determine it, but you might need to submit a regrade for that. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about sort of the architecture that P4 imagined switches have. And in this diagram, we're going to have a bunch of queues. And P4 is not very specific about where the queues are. I'm just imagining we have a bunch of input ports with the queues. And then we have a bunch of internal queues and then a bunch of output ports with queues. These queues are functionality we're not going to implement as a P4 programmer. They're going to be provided by the switch implementation. And then we have these processing steps, and I kind of represented these as stacks because to make a switch high performance, typically we'll run a whole bunch of these in parallel. And we're going to have two what we'll call pipelines. We'll have an ingress pipeline and an egress pipeline. And where is my, that's where that is. Okay, that's it. And the ingress pipeline is probably the most straightforward. It's going to process every frame that comes in. And its primary job usually is to decide where the frame goes. It can do basically everything the egress pipeline does, but usually what we're going to do here is we're going to decide where to forward the frame. And then we run an egress pipeline to process every output frame. And sometimes when we decide to forward a frame, we're going to make multiple copies of it. So if we're broadcasting it to everyone, we're going to end up with, we're going to have the ingress pipeline run one time, and then we're going to have multiple copies of the frame for the egress pipeline. And it will run separately for each copy. And each of these pipelines starts with a parser step. And this is going to decode things from the frame into temporary storage. And you know, that's going to be stuff we're going to use in the actual processing step. And there's also a deparser step, which takes the stuff in temporary storage and puts it back into the frame with the idea that we might have modified it. And in the middle, we have sort of the actual sort of bulk of the work, which is going to be what we'll call a match action pipeline. We'll do basically, in the typical pattern, we'll do a series of table lookups on the parsed fields, and that will determine the actions we'll do. And we'll see the form this will take. It turns out we also can write things that kind of look like normal C code, but yeah, for the interesting and most typical task, like, we're going to focus on doing lots of table lookups. And typical switch hardware is, in fact, going to have special hardware support to make table lookups efficient. And therefore, the P4 language, like, has special things in the language for table lookups. Okay. And P4 is a programming language. You write a program in text, and this is kind of the part of the text file that specifies, you know, your P4 program that specifies the switch instance. In this case, the switch is called main, and we have functions for each of the components. And there's two components we won't talk about, and I didn't talk about, which is these verify checksum and compute checksum. We won't need to change them. That's why I'm not talking about them. But another thing switches will usually have is kind of fixed functionality is hardware to deal with checksumming. So for Ethernet, we know there's an Ethernet checksum. Typically, there will be dedicated hardware that handles verifying those checksums and recomputing those checksums when we output a new frame. And we won't have to write code to do that. Okay. So let's first talk about the parsing step. And kind of as a preliminary thing for the parsing step, we need to figure out how to declare basically structs for headers. And I have this header declaration, which is kind of like a typedef struct declaration in C. And we can see we have this type that, you know, represents 48 bits. And we can represent specific numbers of bits. It doesn't need to be a multiple of a byte because, well, that's how the networks work. They don't always make things multiples of bytes. And that's fine here. And the order here needs to exactly match what's going to be on the network because we're going to copy bits from the network into this struct. If it doesn't match, this is not going to be a good, we're going to have to do something rather different. So here I have a header for Ethernet, and often we'll have our switches or routers will want to process more than just kind of one header. So we'll combine these into a struct that has sort of multiple types of headers we can handle. And I have instances for all the possible headers I could deal with. And generally, not all of these will be valid. And P4 will track which ones of these we've made valid. And in this example, right, we could have packets that only have an Ethernet header and don't use IP. We could have packets that use IPv4. We could have packets that use IPv6. And they'll have different ones, parts of this struct will be valid. So sometimes only the Ethernet part will be valid. Sometimes Ethernet and IPv4, sometimes Ethernet and IPv6, and that's perfectly fine. Okay. questions? Or, yeah.
Yeah, so like what's the, like in the language, like what's the difference between like the, can you declare a header and then you declare a struct?
What's the difference between header and a struct? So header objects basically have some extra methods that we'll see an example of, the most important one being a struct. Other questions? Okay, so then we're gonna write our parser function. So here's kind of the syntax for a parser, and I will say you're gonna start with a working switch, so you're not gonna write these from scratch. And I don't think anyone does, so in their practice. But we have this function here that takes a bunch of parameters. And in P4, they mark the parameters as in or in out sometimes, out or in out sometimes, to represent that there are things you can modify rather than returning, we modify out parameters. So you can see here we have the packet in. So P4 calls the frames packets. They always use the word packet, even though mostly it's Ethernet frames. They just call them all packets all the time. So we have our packet object. We have the headers that we're parsing, that we're going to produce. And we have two metadata objects. So the one that I call meta here, that's a metadata object, that's going to be metadata for my program. And I just defined a struct metadata, basically, that has the information I want to track. We also have this standard metadata T, and this is information for the system. So this is, for example, where we're gonna tell the system, where do I want this packet to go? That's gonna be fields in the standard metadata we're gonna set to say, this packet needs to go to there. This is also where we could find out, for example, which port did this packet come in on? How long did this packet send in queues? That sort of information will be in standard metadata. Okay, so then let's look at our parser. Now that we know how it's declared, let's look at the code inside it. And the parsers here are going to be a state machine. So we have different states. We start in the start state, and things keep going until we end up in the accept state. And we have this transition operation that decides which state to go to next. So in the case of the start state, I unconditionally go to the parse Ethernet state. And that's all I'm doing. In the case of the parse Ethernet state, I first run this extract operation using the Ethernet header. And that's going to basically copy bits from the packet, packet, you can see it's declared this the packet in object here. So it's going to copy bits from that into the Ethernet header object. And how does it know how much to copy? It just knows how big the header is, copies exactly bit by bit. The fields better line up or it's not going to work. And then after I've extracted that header, I can look at one of those header fields and decide what to do next. So we can see I'm doing that here, where I have this transition select, where I decide which stage do I go to next. Do I go to a parse IPv4, parse IPv6 stage, which will look pretty much like this. And basically, each time we call extract, it's going to get more stuff later in the packet. So we call extract starting at the beginning of the packet, then we call it again, it gets to the next part of the packet, so we can keep doing this operation and extract sort of a sequence of headers. Yes?
Is there a particular reason why there isn't a semicolon after IPv6?
That is probably a bug. Okay, some questions? Yeah.
So when you mentioned that it was going to extract something from like each state, does that mean that in
in the parse IPv4 and the parse IPv6 functions, there's another extract call?
Yes. So parse IPv4 is going to do packet.extract and header.ipv4, and that's going to know to get the next stuff in the packet. So basically, the extract operation keeps track of how much we've taken off the front of the packet. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about how we can use this. So here, let's say I have this packet format. I have a source destination. I have a flag is their timestamp, a flag is their data, 6 unused bits, a timestamp, if the timestamp present flag is set, and a data size, and some data. How should I represent this so I can make a parser for it in P4? So what sort of header should I have? So I should have, you know, header blank. Here, how many of these do I need is the first question. How many headers should I have define? Yeah. Three? Okay.
Like, so one for the just the data that's present always, and then one for the timestamp, and then one for both data size and data, because they could be present or not.
Okay, so you want to have one for the part of the header that's fixed, and then kind of extra headers for these optional things, which we can, one way we can view them is kind of extra headers. And yeah, I don't think this is the only way of doing things. Like, the extract operation's a little more flexible than I've shown, but this is the most straightforward way of handling things that look like, say, TCP options, is that you have these extra headers that, even though this is one header, we will parse it as multiple headers to do that. And you said you'd have a header with the data size and the data. Probably the data is not part of a header. We probably won't be hopefully won't be dealing with that.
Oh, yeah.
In the switch. If we do, well, that's going to be fun. We're allowed to, but we hopefully won't be. So I would say we're going to define sort of header objects for these three pieces. And the reason I've chosen those three pieces is that means that I don't need to do any sort of funny special extract operation. I can use a normal extract, and it's just going to be, are these parts found? So I'll have like a header, say main, and a header timestamp, and a header sort of data info for each of those pieces. And then I'm going to have a parser where I'm going to go, I don't know, when do we teach state machines? Do we not wait till DSA2 to do that? So people here haven't seen it.
It's
DMT2. Oh, even later, okay. Okay, yeah, that still is only a very small subset. Okay, so we're going to start, so I'm going to draw a state machine here. So we're going to start in our start state, and these arrows represent possible transitions, right? And then we're going to go to parse main. And from there, one option would be we go to accept. But we also might go to the parse timestamps, which I'll just represent with TS. And we also might go to the parse the data info. And from timestamps, we might go to data info, or we might go to accept. And we'll go from data info to accept. So we'll have to build our state transitions to have a conditional transition that after we parse the main header, we need to figure out, do I go to the timestamp next or the data side next? After I parse the timestamp header, even though I just extracted the timestamp header, I need to look back at the main header and check, is there data? And then decide, do I parse the data info header or not? So that would be the parser we'd build there. Build to do this. Some questions? How I came up with that answer? Yeah.
Is there a reason why this is in this particular order? Like, why does it check timestamp before data size?
Why am I checking timestamp before data size? Just because this is the packet format. Because I chose to, when I send things on the wire, to put the timestamp before the data size.
Okay.
If I chose the other way, we'd have to change this. Yeah.
So just so I'm understanding correctly, when you reach the timestamp or the data size states, you have a parser and does it take you back to the main parser?
I have a parser that takes it back to no. So, I have a slide for this. How about that? So like our headers will look something like this, right? And basically I'm gonna have in parse basic, I'm gonna then, you know, if it has a timestamp, I'm gonna go to parse timestamp. If it has data, I'm gonna go to parse data. Otherwise I'm gonna go to accept in parse timestamp if it has data. And this is going to be, you know, if header.basic.hasData, right? We're gonna look at the basic header that we parsed in the previous state to figure this out. Does that answer your question? So using this, we can build parsers that deal with headers that are not very regular. It turns out that if you look at protocol design, people have wisened up in the past 30 years, and tried harder to make header sizes fixed because that's just easier for switches and routers. But we can handle non-fixed header sizes. Other questions? Okay, so then let's talk about our ingress processing. And I said the main role here was to can set where our output is. And the easiest way of doing that is that we can modify the egress spec field in standard metadata to be the output port number. A switch will have some number of ports. That depends on what's configured. So I can say egress spec equals 4, and that will say the current packet should go to output port 4. And there's going to be some hard-coded phase, the one that, it, you know, after our ingress pipeline, there will be some hard-coded stuff that looks at egress spec and puts the packet in the appropriate queues for that. There's a special value for discard. So if you just want to drop something, there's a special value you can put here, which is drop it. Questions. So this sets the output to go to a particular port, but that's pretty useless. Because usually we want to make a decision. And to make a decision, we're going to want to decide which output port, probably based on a table lookup most frequently. So we want to have a table. We're going to look at, take something in the header, look up that as a key in our table. The table's going to be basically a dictionary. And that's going to tell us what action to do next. Most commonly, the action will be go to some port. It could also be like send back an error message, discard the packet, broadcast it. We can write various different actions that basically are just going to set different metadata fields for the most part. And figure out why. And P4 really wants to support tables, so we have special syntax for tables and table lookups. So here's a declaration of a table. This is something we can do as part of our ingress or egress pipeline. And Tables are a key value structure. The keys are going to be one or more fields from the header. So we could have more fields here that are part of this key. In this case, I only have one field, the source, the destination address. And I'm indicating my values, which are going to be the actions, are either drop or this forward to action. And I give a size for the table to store, and I have a default value. If we look up something in the table and it's not there, it's not going to fail. It's going to do the default. And the default is to run this drop action with no arguments. And in this case, I have colon exact. And you might say, well, why do I have to specify that? That's because these tables support partial matches. And that's a really important feature for switches. So before I talk about how those partial matches work, questions about our table structure. And I guess I will show you sort of what is this forward to, how do I define that forward to action in a bit. But questions about our table structure. Okay, so I'm doing this table here. My key is an exact match on the destination address. I can do other types of matches, and there's kind of three that P4 supports. So the exact match is like a quality. You're checking, are all the bits the same? They also support a longest prefix match, where the table entries don't contain a full, in this case, an address. They just contain the first part of an address, and we'll find, the key in the table that has the same part beginning. That matches that. So we'll have the, So let's say I'm looking for 0x012. I'll have table entries that are like 0x012 blank blank, 0x0123 blank, and 0x0124 blank, and things like that, or like 0, 1, 2, 3, 5. And in this case, 0x1234, we'd say, what's the longest prefix that matches of these? And we'd say, okay, 0x12, that matches 8 bits. 0x123, anything that matches 12 bits. This does not match, and this does not match, so our longest prefix matches this one. So that's how we do the lookup. So all our entries would say, it's this prefix plus anything, and we look for the longest prefix that is actually a match. So that's that. There's also a mode called ternary, where rather than storing a value to match with, we kind of store bits with don't care bits. So the reason this is called ternary is that a way we can represent this is that rather than saying I want it to match, something like this, we'll say I don't care about some of the bits. So our keys will be things like 0, 1, a bunch of question marks, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, and we'll look for a match where we ignore the question marks in the keys. So our keys will have these question mark bits rather than 0 or 1. And when we look up keys, we will just say if everything but the question mark bits match, we don't care what the question mark bits actually are in the value, or sorry, in the key we're looking up. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Is it possible for the ternary operation to result in conflicting decisions?
Isn't it possible for it to result in conflicting decisions? Yes, so there can be multiple keys that match. I don't know what the policy is for how it decides which one you get. I would assume that either it's the most matching or it's arbitrary. I don't actually know which policy. Yeah, answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, and P4 part of the reason why P4 has these tables is that high-end routers and switches for a very long time have had special hardware commonly known as content addressable memory, including ternary content addressable memory. And this is basically hardware that implements the table lookup. And for ternary content addressable memory, it implements that ternary table lookup in hardware. And this is kind of what you need to do if you like want to have a router that can work at like 25 gigabits. You need something, some hardware like this to make that really work. And presumably the reason P4 has tables, therefore, is that they want to be able to compile down to something that takes advantage of the specialized hardware that routers and switches have for doing these table lookups. And if you, so this is not a hardware class, we're not gonna talk about how CAM works, but it's similar to very highly associative caches, basically. Typically means we have lots of comparators. And CAM is kind of a precious resource. So TCAM, so sort of like has like apparently like 2.7 times more transistors for a typical design than SRAM, which is typically what like L1 caches are made out of. And it probably uses a lot more power than SRAM. And it's hard to find recent quotes for this, but for example, I looked up the price of a Broadcom chip that has about 40 megabits of TCAM. And it's about $180 for that chip that runs at 900 megahertz and has an 80 watt power, needs an 80 watt heatsink. So we're not going to have gigabytes of TCAM. We're going to have megabytes of TCAM. Not typically. This is kind, you know, we can't just be willy-nilly. We have a lot of it. It's hard to know how much of that chip's price is this specialized memory because the chip does a bunch of other things. It's an add-on chip for routers. It's a knowledge processing engine. Its main job is to do table lookup type stuff, but it's not clear how much is the table lookup versus some other fixed functionality. Okay, so questions about tables. So let's talk about using our tables and actions in our tables. So in our apply operation, rather than just setting a field, we can apply a table. And that's going to do lookup, use the key the table specifies, which is based on our headers that were passed into the ingress function. And it's going to run the corresponding action. And I defined the, you know, said what the actions were, I named them, but I didn't actually define them. So let's look at what the actions are written up in code. So here's like how I can write actions. And you can notice that some actions can have parameters. So in this case, my forward to action takes a port number, and the table will store not just that it's forward to as the value, but it's forward to and the port number. So the table can store the action and its parameters. And it can deal with actions having different number of parameters. So the drop action, for example, takes no parameters. It just calls this mark to drop function to set the packet is dropped information on standard metadata. And you can notice that, you know, our actions can do more than just setting where the packet goes. They can modify headers and things like that. And there's, you know, a bunch of C-like stuff you can do in the action code. So questions on actions? Okay. So there's some operations that are a little tricky. That we're going to want to do for packets. So it's, we've seen that we can set this egress back to say, where does the packet go out? We can also mark a packet to be dropped, which is actually going to be basically setting egress back to a negative one-like value. But there's two other things that are kind of useful things to do to packets. So one is that we want to send the packet to the control plane. So our P4 program, it's limited in the types of processing we can do. So sometimes we might want to send it to something that's going to do more advanced processing. And the biggest thing we're going to want to do is we want to edit table entries. And we can't edit table entries from P4 programs. We can use tables, but the contents of the tables are going to be set by the control plane. So if we want something to be added to the table, we need to ask the control plane for help. And in our upcoming assignment, this is why we're going to use the send packet to control plane operations. We're going to send a packet to the control plane so it can look at it and run the operation to edit those tables. We're not going to be able to edit the table ourselves from the data plane program. The data plane just applies the tables. It doesn't have write access to any of the tables. The other operation you might want to do is multicast or broadcast packets. So broadcast is send it to everyone. And there's a generalization of that called multicast, where we send to multiple people, but not necessarily everyone. We have a list we want to send to. And the way that works in P4 is the control plane can set up what are called multicast groups. And when you send the packet to a multicast group, it sends it to everyone who's on a list the control plane set up. And for the assignment, we're going to set up a multicast group that is actually broadcast because the list is going to be everyone. But this is more flexible than that in case you want to send to some but not all of the output ports. Okay. Are there questions on these special actions? Okay, so let's talk briefly about, we talked about tables. Let's think about how would we use tables. So let's say I want to implement this policy here. By default, packets sent to some specific servers, A, B, C, and D, are dropped. And specific machines have permission to contact server A. The same is true for B, C, and D. And some specific machines are given access to contact all servers. What tables would be useful to have to implement this policy? So in our data plane, we're going to set up tables, and we're going to be able to configure those tables to, specify the specifics of our policy, which is probably going to be the specific what are the addresses of all these servers and these machines that have special privileges. So what would be good tables to have? What would your keys be? Can someone, any volunteer for what would be a good table key to have for this? Yeah.
I guess you'd want to, for the first line, you'd want to filter out, you want to know the addresses of A, B, C, and D, so you'd want to have some rule that matches those specific machines and drops.
Table with key equals the destination address and to find packets to A, B, C, D. Yeah, that would be very useful. Other things here? Yeah.
The source address is used. The machine sending the packets information.
Okay, so key equals source address. So source address would be one way of doing this. If we're an assumption we're making in that is that the source address is accurate. So maybe if we don't trust that, we might use the input port number. But one of those two. And so let's talk about it. So we have two tables so far, one and two. And And I would say table one is really good for our first idea, right? We can implement that by default policy that if nothing at the end of our thing, if nothing matched, like the action we're going to do is going to do a table, apply a table to check, do we drop this? Good for that policy. And table two is good for this last policy, right? We can look up to see where the packet came from and decide, do we want to skip all the checks or not? But we're missing something we might want to have. And I guess I can say we can have basic if statements in P4 code for like do we do a table lookup, but yeah. But we can't obviously compare to a list of machines, which is the big thing we're going to try to avoid. But we're kind of missing something for the second item. So if I were implementing this, I would want to have a third table where our key is the combination of the destination address and the input port. And that would be what I'd use to implement that specific machines can contact specific servers policy. Questions on how I came up with this answer? Yeah.
So technically we don't actually need table two, right? Given that we have table three.
So the question is technically we don't need table two given that we have table three. So that's a good so that depends on our match strategy. So if we use a match strategy of exact, we would need both. But what we could do is we could have, I'll call this 2B. We could have a table where the key is going to be our destination address, exact, and our input port, ternary, for example. Or probably not ternary, probably like least prefix match, for example. In that case, we could set a default input port rule that would apply. Longest prefix. So yes, we could avoid a table, like we could actually combine some of these tables because we have these kind of partial matching functionality. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's on tables. So then we have ingress processing. There's also egress processing. It's the same as ingress, but in a different function. And the parser and deparser actually are the same, just the table lookup function is different. And in the upcoming assignment, the code we give you uses this egress processing to deal with duplicate packets. So when we send a packet out, if we try to broadcast it, we send it to a multicast group that includes everybody. And everybody includes whoever sent the packet. But we don't want to send them back their own packet. So to avoid that, in egress processing, we drop the packet there. So that's an example of a possible usage of this step. Questions on egress processing. Okay, so let's talk about the control plane. And in P4, the control plane is an ordinary program that basically contacts the switches via a network interface to run the commands to load new programs into the data plane, to set table entries, configure multicast groups, or to receive frames to process them itself. And I'm going to show code for the P4 controller in the upcoming assignment. And I based stuff off the P4 tutorial code that P4 developers have used for sessions they've had at conferences showing people how to use P4. And this has a library which has some wrapper functions for the kind of raw interface. So we're kind of a little abstracted away. But this is all going to be Python code. That's what the assignment's going to be for that, because that's what the libraries they use are. But it's actually communicating with the network, with a switch over a network connection. So you could write this in any language. And also, like, a bunch of the boilerplate is taken care of for us by this library. So let's look at each of these operations. So one of the things we can do with the switches is we can actually load a program for the data plane. So the way that works in the interface we'll be using in the assignment is that we get this P4 info helper and switch objects, and then we first connect to the switch and configure ourselves as the primary controller using this master arbitration update command to say, I am the primary controller. And this exists because the switch supports multiple controllers, because in a real network, you want to handle failures of one controller. And then we set the forwarding pipeline, which is going to be our data plane. And the important part of this is we actually compile the P4 code to a file, and we specify that file here, and that gets loaded into the switch program. So then we move to set table entries, and I have a wrapper function for that we'll be using called write or overwrite table entries. We're going to pass it those two objects that will supply you code that will create them to identify the switch and the sort of stuff about our configuration. And then we're going to specify the name of the table. In this case, is a table in the ingress step called myingress. So I do myingress.macdestexact because it was declared in the myingress function, and it's called table macdest_exact. And then I specify the specific values of the fields. The format's a little different if it's not an exact match. Our assignment probably only needs exact matches, which is why that's all I'm showing. But we write something like prefix length, if it was, say, least prefix match, for example. And then we specify our action and any function parameters for the action. And as I mentioned, this is not the raw function for this. This is a wrapper we'll use in the assignment that just automates some very boilerplate stuff. So questions on sort of editing the table? So I also mentioned we had multicast groups. And in particular, we're going to supply you code that does a broadcast operation. But to make that work, we can't just say broadcast everywhere. Instead, I need to actually send a command to the switch to set up a multicast group. And this is what that looks like. You probably will not modify this code, but we're going to configure this multicast group. It's going to have an ID. And then in our ingress code, we're going to write this line to say, this packet goes to this multicast group. And then the part of the switch that looks at it after the ingress step is going to look at that field and say, oh, okay, I better handle this packet by copying it a bunch of times. And we're going to have a list of ports for it to go to. So I have ingress port 1, 2, 3, 4. There's an instance field. I leave it 0. The idea of that is that if we have stuff in the egress pipeline that wants to do different things for different copies of the packet, it can use that field to figure out which copy it's looking at. We're not going to use it. Okay, and you might say, what's this PRE? PRE stands for Packet Replication Engine. It also supports something called clone sessions, which I'm not going to show, but you know, is other ways of making copies of the packet. Question on our multicast group? Okay. So then we can receive frames to process them. And the code for that is going to look like this. So our switch object is going to have this thing we can do a for loop on, which is actually going to work by contacting the network. There's a bunch of Python wizardry going on. It's not actually an array, or list, rather. It's a special object where when you iterate over it, actually reads things off the network. And some of the things won't be packets, but if there are packets, we can get the payload and the metadata. The payload is the bytes of the frame that, you know, come from deparsing it, like what we send on the network. And then we have some extra metadata that you can set with the packet. We probably won't make real use of that, but you know, I guess we will make a little use of that. Like just, for example, a thing we can put here is what port did it come in on? And we wouldn't normally know that. That can be added there, even though it's not part of the packet. And the way this is going to work is that we're going to direct things to the controller by sending them to a special port number. So basically, we have ports 1, 2, 3, and 4 that the switch is actually connected to. And we have this special port called the CPU port that goes to the controller. But sending stuff to the controller is just, instead of sending stuff to port 1, 2, 3, or 4, we send stuff to the CPU port, which in our assignment will be port 510. And then we can pick it up here in our Python code. Yeah?
Just making sure, when we're doing multicast or broadcast, we're not actually making a physical copy of the packet, right? We're just sending it to different egress ports?
Question, when we do multicast or broadcast, we're not making a physical copy of the packet. We are making extra copies of the packet. So if we think of our sort of basic model of P4 here, if we set a multicast group, we're actually going to end up with multiple copies of the packet after the ingress step.
So if I'm broadcasting, if I'm always broadcasting, wouldn't it result in a exponential explosion of number of packets?
Question, wouldn't it result in an exponential explosion of number of packets? So only if you receive the stuff you send out. Right, so if we think of our typical switch, I have a diagram for this, right? When I send stuffing out on all four of my ports, they're just going to these machines and this other switch. As long as those don't send it back to me, it's fine. If they send it back to me, yeah, it's really bad. And that is actually a real problem in real networks, but we'll talk about that later when we talk about routing. Or guess, but yes, that is fine. Okay, so other questions on picture? So let's talk about sort of the typical usage of these tables. So typically, you know, we're going to have, let's say here we have a simple network with two switches, and I've numbered the output ports on the switch. So each switch has four output ports, and we need to set up a table to say, where do they send stuff to? And we have different MAC addresses for each of these machines at the edges of the network, and basically I want to construct this table here, that if I'm sending to AA over here, or B, FF is wrong here, sorry. So if I'm sending to BB or AA or FF, I want to go to port 1 from this switch, because that's going to go through that other switch. If I'm sending to CC, I want to go to port 2. If I'm sending to DD, I want to go to port 3. If I'm sending to EE, I want to go to port 9. So I want to set up this table. And similarly, for the other switch, I want to set up this table that I hopefully didn't screw up. Here. So basically, I'm just looking at what path do I have to take. There's only one on this simple network. And we're going to talk about networks where there's only one path to sort out. We'll talk about routing when there's multiple paths later. That's going to be a much more complicated topic. So these are the tables I want to configure. And if we think of our controller, I basically want my controller to run the commands to set all these table entries. And that's how my switch is going to work. And you know, this is a thing we can do, but for real networks, this is really annoying, right? If we imagine how this is going to work in practice, do I want my system administrator to type in all these tables by hand? You know, and when we move a machine from one switch to another, I have to update all the tables and all the switches. Even if I have a tool to do that, that's still tedious because I have to like go to this tool, say, oh, this machine is on this port now. Now let's reconfigure all the switches. In addition to actually physically plugging and unplugging the machine and plugging it back into a different port. You know, that seems really annoying. So this is something we can do, but it's really error prone, really hard to change. So we're going to have this alternate idea, and this is the main functionality we're going to implement in the P4 homework, where the switch is going to figure out this table. And this idea is called map learning. And basically the idea is that we're going to start out with a forwarding table that works. I told you we always have the backup option of broadcasting. So that's going to be our default. We're going to have a default entry just sent to everyone. And then we're going to get a frame coming in. So let's say I got this frame on port 2. What should I do with it? Looking at our table, what should I do? This is an easy question. What? Broadcast. So we're going to send it to everyone but where it came from. But there's another thing we can do here, which is we can say, oh, this came from port 2. That source address, you know, if I want to send something back to it, I should send it on the same port. So let's add that entry for future packets that are returning this, that are sending back to the sender. So let's copy the source address as a destination address in our table. Now, later on, when you know someone replies to that packet, we can say, oh, now the destination address matches something I saw earlier because I recorded it when it was being sent. So now it's in my table, and I will send to the correct output port. And I can look at the source address of this and say, oh, that's not in my table, let's fix that. So we'll just do this over and over. And basically, in the normal operation of the network, we should figure out the actual correct contents of this table automatically. And if a machine moves from one port to another, well, we'll overwrite its table entry, ideally, with you know the new thing once it sends something with the correct source address. Yeah.
Port number like a very safe thing to assume it's accurate?
Is port number a safe thing to assume it's accurate? So in our switch, right, this is like physically which wire did it come in on. So yes. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So it's not part of the packet, it's metadata. That's why I have it above a line. Okay, so this idea is called map learning, and it is something switches usually do because it allows us to, you know, not to have, make it so you don't have to configure a switch. So if you ever use like an Ethernet switch in a kind of home network, most likely you didn't configure it at all. You just plugged it in and it just worked, and this is why. It's doing this, you didn't have to type in MAC addresses or anything like that. Yeah.
If the port number changed, I assume that it also updated in the table?
So if the port number changed, it also updated in the table? Yes. So to do this in the assignment, we don't actually care if you do the updates correctly. But what the switches should do for map learning is look at the source, see if they, if a packet comes in with a source address that doesn't match the port number we saw earlier, update the table to make it match. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So for the assignment, I don't care if you handle that case or not. You're allowed to just assume the first one you see is going to be that same port number forever. But in a real switch, we'd have to basically check every packet that's coming in. Have I seen this source address with this particular port or not? So we'd have a table that was keyed on the source address and the port number, input port number to check that. Okay, so one thing I did here is I said we're gonna set it back to all but two. And this is not just an optimization. We aren't just saving time by doing this. This is vital for our network not to collapse. And let me, and I guess I probably don't have enough time to do this question, but let's talk about what happens if we don't do all but two. If we just say, let's send it to all. Why is that a bad idea? So if we have a network like this, let's say, you know, I'm sending a packet here and we don't know where it goes, so we're just gonna broadcast it. Okay? And if we don't, if we send it backwards, okay, we sent an extra copy. So this is where you might think, it's not a big deal, right? That's not a big deal. We're just gonna ignore it. We know it's not important, no problem. But the issue is that we're gonna send it to this other switch. And this other switch is gonna do the same thing. And when it does the same thing, oh, we're sending a copy back here. So far, no problem. But we're going to keep applying the same rule. And, well, and when this packet came in on port 1, we broadcast it to everyone. Probably going to do the same thing when it comes on port 4. Those rules don't really change. So we're going to send it everywhere here, including sending a copy back to the original switch. And then the original switch is going to keep sending it back. And basically, this packet will be keep getting sent across the network forever. So that's real bad. So we're not gonna do that. That is a real bad thing. We just overwhelms the link quickly. But this is gonna have another, this problem is gonna have another consequence, which is that this network design, we're gonna need to do something extra to make it work. If we just do the MAC learning thing I talked about with the default of broadcast, this network topology doesn't work. So we're going to have to, we're going to want to support it, but we're going to have to do some extra steps. We're going to talk about that much later in the semester, what those extra steps are. But with this topology, we have the problem that, you know, I send my packet here, it goes out, and yeah, I'm not sending things backwards, but that's not gonna be enough because I'm gonna send something to this switch and to this switch from here. And then this switch is gonna send something to here and this switch is gonna send something to here. And then their packets are gonna go back to here and each of those are gonna send to the other one. And we'll basically have this loop where the packet goes around and around like so. And Ethernet's solution to this is don't do it. For IP, well, it's not quite don't do it. Ethernet solution, there's some other solutions on Ethernet we'll talk about later, but the simplest solution is don't do it. There's a better solution, actually, we'll talk about later. But this is a problem we're gonna have to solve, and we'll talk about it when we talk about routing, how we actually solve this problem. But I just something I want you to be aware of, that the basic MAC learning strategy like doesn't deal with this type of issue. We're gonna need to talk about more sophisticated ways of configuring our network to avoid this problem. But as long as we don't have loops like this, the MAC learning approach is all you need. And it has the great advantage of requiring absolutely no configuration. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. Yeah, I guess I'll say, yeah. So that's a preview of routing. So we're gonna do routing later. And a lot of the routing ideas will apply to Ethernet too. And are in fact are done in Ethernet, just on a smaller scale. But we're gonna focus on it when we talk about how the internet works, because that's where the more interesting solutions are. So we'll talk about how do we solve this loop problem, and also how do we just more intelligently make these tables when we talk about IP internet protocol RAM. And our next topic that Professor Campbell will talk about is what happens when we're sending IP over Ethernet. How does that work locally? Because the biggest disconnect you might have noticed is we have MAC addresses, which are not IP addresses. So we'll talk about that issue.